Recorded Books Romance presents an unabridged recording of On the Way to the Wedding by Julia Quinn, narrated by Simon Preble.
Chapter 13, in which our heroine sees a glimpse of her future. 1 month later. The food was exquisite, the table settings magnificent, the surroundings beyond opulent. Lucy, however, was miserable. Lord Hazelby and his father, the Earl of Davenport, had come to Fensworth House in London for supper. It had been Lucy's idea, a fact which she now found painfully ironic. Her wedding was a mere week away, and yet until this night she hadn't even seen her future husband. Not since the wedding had shifted from probable to imminent, anyway. She and her uncle had arrived in London a fortnight earlier, and after 11 days had passed without a glimpse of her intended, she had approached her uncle and asked if they might arrange some sort of gathering. He had looked rather irritated, although not, Lucy was fairly certain, because he thought the request foolish. No, her mere presence was all it required to bring on such an expression. She was standing in front of him, and he had been forced to look up. Uncle Robert did not like to be interrupted. But he apparently saw the wisdom in allowing an affianced couple to share a word or two before they met at a church. So he had curtly told her that he would make the arrangements. Buoyed by her small victory, Lucy had also asked if she might attend one of the many social events that were taking place practically right outside her door. The London social season had begun, and each night Lucy stood at her window watching the elegant carriages roll by. Once there had been a party directly across St. James's Square from Fensworth House. The line of carriages had snaked around the square, and Lucy had snuffed the candles in her room so that she would not be silhouetted in the window as she watched the proceedings. A number of partygoers had grown impatient with the wait, and since the weather was so fine, they had disembarked on her side of the square and walked the rest of the way. Lucy had told herself that she just wanted to see the gowns. But in her heart, she knew the truth. She was looking for Mr. Bridgerton. She didn't know what she would do if she actually saw him. Duck out of sight, she supposed. He had to know that this was her home, and surely he would be curious enough to glance at the facade, even if her presence in London was not a widely known fact. But he didn't attend that party. Or if he did, his carriage had deposited him right at the front doorstep. Or maybe he wasn't in London at all. Lucy had no way of knowing. She was trapped in the house with her uncle and her aging, slightly deaf aunt Harriet, who had been brought in for the sake of propriety. Lucy left the house for trips to the dressmaker and walks in the park, but other than that, she was completely on her own, with an uncle who did not speak and an aunt who could not hear. So she was not generally privy to gossip about Gregory Bridgerton or anyone for that matter. And even on the odd occasion when she did see someone she knew, she couldn't very well ask after him. People would think she was interested. Which, of course, she was. But no one, absolutely no one, could ever know of it. She was marrying someone else. In a week. And even if she weren't, Gregory Bridgerton had shown no sign that he might be interested in taking Hazelby's place. He had kissed her, that was true. And he had seemed concerned for her welfare. But if he was of the belief that a kiss demanded a proposal of marriage, he had made no indication. He had not known that her engagement to Hazelby had been finalized, not when he'd kissed her, and not the following morning when they had stood awkwardly in the drive. He could only have believed that he was kissing a girl who was entirely unattached. One simply did not do such a thing, unless one was ready and willing to step up to the altar. But not Gregory. When she had finally told him, he hadn't looked stricken. He hadn't even looked mildly upset. There had been no pleas to reconsider or to try and find a way out of it. All she'd seen in his face, and she had looked, oh, how she had looked, was nothing. His face, his eyes, they had been almost blank. Maybe a touch of surprise, but no sorrow or relief. Nothing to indicate that her engagement meant anything to him, one way or another. Oh, she did not think him a cad, and she was quite sure he would have married her had it been necessary. But no one had seen them, and thus, as far as the rest of the world was concerned, it had never happened. There were no consequences. for either of them. But wouldn't it have been nice if he'd seemed just a little bit upset? He'd kissed her, and the earth had shook. Surely he'd felt it. Shouldn't he have wanted more? Shouldn't he have wanted, if not to marry her, then at least the possibility of doing so? Instead, he'd said, "I wish you the best," and it had sounded so final. As she'd stood there, watching her trunks being loaded into the carriage, she had felt her heart breaking. Felt it, right there in her chest. It had hurt. And as she walked away, it had just got worse, pressing and squeezing until she thought it would steal her very breath. She'd begun to move faster as she could while maintaining a normal gait, and then finally she rounded a corner and collapsed onto a bench, letting her face fall helplessly into her hands, and prayed that no one saw her. She'd wanted to look back. She'd wanted to steal one last glance at him and memorize his stance, that singular way he held himself when he stood, hands behind his back, legs slightly apart. Lucy knew that hundreds of men stood the same way, but on him, it was different. He could be facing the other direction, yards and yards away, and she would know it was he. He walked differently, too, a little bit loose and easy-going, as if a small part of his heart was still 7 years old. It was in the shoulders, the hips maybe, the sort of thing almost no one would notice. But Lucy had always paid attention to details. But she hadn't looked back. It would have only made it worse. He probably wasn't watching her, but if he were, and he saw her turn around, it would have been devastating. She wasn't sure why, but it would. She didn't want him to see her face. She had managed to remain composed through their conversation, but once she turned away, she had felt herself change. Her lips had parted, and she'd sucked in a huge breath, and it was as if she had hollowed herself out. It was awful, and she didn't want him to see it. Besides, he wasn't interested. He had all but fallen over himself to apologize for the kiss. She knew it was what he had to do. Society dictated it. Or, if not that, then a quick trip to the altar. But it hurt all the same. She'd wanted to think he'd felt at least a tiny fraction of what she had. Not that anything would come of it, but it would have made her feel better. Or maybe worse. And in the end, it didn't matter. It didn't matter what her heart did or didn't know, because she couldn't do anything with it. What was the point of feelings if one couldn't use them towards a tangible end? She had to be practical. It was what she was. It was her only constant in a world that was spinning far too quickly for her comfort. But still, here in London, she wanted to see him. It was silly, and it was foolish, and it was most certainly unadvisable. But she wanted it all the same. She didn't even have to speak with him. In fact, she probably shouldn't speak with him. But a glimpse. A glimpse wouldn't hurt anyone. But when she had asked Uncle Robert if she might attend a party, he had refused, stating that there was little point in wasting time or money on the season when she was already in possession of the desired outcome, a proposal of marriage. Furthermore, he informed her, Lord Davenport wished for Lucy to be introduced to society as Lady Hazelby, not as Lady Lucinda Abernethy. Lucy wasn't sure why this was important, especially as quite a few members of society already knew her as Lady Lucinda Abernethy, both from school and the polishing she and Hermione had undergone that spring. But Uncle Robert had indicated, in his inimitable manner, that is to say, without a word, that the interview was over, and he had already returned his attention to the papers on his desk. For a brief moment, Lucy had remained in place. If she said his name, he might look up. Or he might not. But if he did, his patience would be thin, and she would feel like an annoyance, and she wouldn't receive any answers to her questions anyway. So she just nodded and left the room. Although heaven only knew why she had bothered to nod, Uncle Robert never looked back up once he dismissed her. And now here she was, at supper, she herself had requested, and she was wishing fervently that she had never opened her mouth. Hazelby was fine, perfectly pleasant even. But his father. Lucy prayed she would not be living at the Davenport residence. Please, please let Hazelby have his own home, in Wales, or maybe France. Lord Davenport had, after complaining about the weather, the House of Commons, and the opera, which he found, respectively, rainy, full of ill-bred idiots, and by God not even in English, then turned his critical eye on her. It had taken all of Lucy's fortitude not to back up as he descended upon her. He looked rather like an overweight fish, with bulbous eyes and thick, fleshy lips. Truly, Lucy would not have been surprised if he had torn off his shirt to reveal gills and scales. And then, ew, she shuddered just to remember it. He stepped close, so close that his hot, stale breath puffed around her face. She stood rigidly, with the perfect posture that had been drilled into her since birth. He told her to show her teeth. It had been humiliating. Lord Davenport had inspected her like a broodmare, even going so far as to place his hands on her hips to measure them for potential childbirth. Lucy had gasped and glanced frantically at her uncle for help, but he was stone-faced and staring resolutely at a spot that was not her face. And now that they had sat to eat, good heavens, Lord Davenport was interrogating her. He had asked every conceivable question about her health, covering areas she was quite certain were not suitable for mixed company, and then, just when she thought the worst of it was over,
"Can you do your tables?"
Lucy blinked. "I beg your pardon?"
"Your tables," he said impatiently. "Sixes, sevens."
For a moment Lucy could not speak. He wanted her to do maths.
"Well?"
he demanded. "Of course," she stammered. She looked again to her uncle, but he was maintaining his expression of determined disinterest.
"Show me."
Davenport's mouth settled into a firm line in his jowly cheeks.
"Sevens will do."
Utterly desperate, she even tried to catch Aunt Harriet's eye, but she was completely oblivious to the proceedings, and in fact had not uttered a word since the evening had begun.
"Father," Hazelby interrupted, "surely you..." "It's all about breathing," Lord Davenport said curtly. "The future of the family lies in her womb. We have a right to know what we're getting."
Lucy's lips parted in shock. Then she realized she'd moved a hand to her abdomen. Hastily, she allowed it to drop. Her eyes shot back and forth between father and son, not sure whether she was supposed to speak.
"The last thing you want is a woman who thinks too much," Lord Davenport was saying. "But she ought to be able to do something as basic as multiplication. Good God, son, think of the ramifications."
Lucy looked to Hazelby. He looked back, apologetically. She swallowed and shut her eyes for a fortifying moment. When she opened them, Lord Davenport was staring straight at her, and his lips were parting, and she realized he was going to speak again, which he positively could not bear. "And 7, 14, 21, she blurted out, cutting him off as best she could. 28, 35, 42. She wondered what he would do if she botched it. Would he call off the marriage? 49, 56. It was tempting, so tempting. 63, 70, 77. She looked at her uncle. He was eating. He wasn't even looking at her. 82, 89.
"That's enough,"
Lord Davenport announced, coming in right atop the 82. The giddy feeling in her chest quickly drained away. She'd rebelled, possibly for the first time in her entire life, and no one had noticed. She'd waited too long. She wondered what else she should have done already. "Well done," Hazelby said, with an encouraging smile. Lucy managed a little smile in return. He really wasn't bad. In fact, if not for Gregory, she would have thought him a rather fine choice. Hazelby's hair was perhaps a little thin, and actually he was a little thin as well, but that wasn't really anything to complain about, especially as his personality, surely the most important aspect of any man, was perfectly agreeable. They had managed a short conversation before supper while his father and her uncle were discussing politics, and he had been quite charming. He had even made a dry, sideways sort of joke about his father, accompanied by a roll of the eyes that had made Lucy chuckle. Truly, she shouldn't complain. And she didn't. She wouldn't. She just wished for something else.
"'I trust you acquitted yourself acceptably at Miss Moss's?'
Lord Davenport asked, his eyes narrowed just enough to make his query not precisely friendly.
"'Yes, of course,' Lucy replied, blinking with surprise. She'd thought the conversation had veered away from her.
"'Excellent institution,'
Davenport said, chewing on a piece of roasted lamb.
"'They know what a girl should and should not know. Winslow's daughter went there. Fordham's, too.'
"'Yes,' Lucy murmured, since reply seemed to be expected. "'They are both very sweet girls,'
she lied. Sibylla Winslow was a nasty little tyrant who thought it good fun to pinch the upper arms of the younger students. But for the first time that evening, Lord Davenport appeared to be pleased with her.
"'You know them well, then?'
he asked.
"'Somewhat,' Lucy hedged. "'Lady Joanna was a bit older, but it's not a large school. One can't really not know the other students.'
"'Good.'
Lord Davenport nodded approvingly, his jowls quivering with the movement. Lucy tried not to look.
"'These are the people you will need to know,' he went on. "'Connections that you must cultivate.'
Lucy nodded dutifully, all the while making a mental list of all the places she would rather be. Paris, Venice, Greece, although weren't they at war? No matter, she would still rather be in Greece.
"'Responsibility to the name, certain standards of behaviour.
Was it very hot in the Orient? She'd always admired Chinese vases.
"'Will not tolerate any deviation from—'
What was the name of that dreadful section of town? St. Giles? Yes, she'd rather be there as well.
Obligations. Obligations.
This last was accompanied by a fist on the table, causing the silver to rattle and Lucy to jerk in her seat. Even Aunt Harriet looked up from her food. Lucy snapped to attention, and because all eyes were on her, she said,
"Yes?"
Lord Davenport leaned in, almost menacingly.
"Some day you'll be Lady Davenport. You will have obligations, many obligations."
Lucy managed to stretch her lips just enough to count as a response. Dear God, when would this evening end? Lord Davenport leaned in, and even though the table was wide and laden with food, Lucy instinctively backed away.
"You cannot take lightly your responsibilities," he continued, his voice rising scarily in volume. "Do you understand me, girl?"
Lucy wondered what would happen if she clasped her hand to her head and shouted it out. "God in heaven, put an end to this torture!"
Yes, she thought, almost analytically. That might very well put him off. Maybe he would judge her unsound of mind, and...
"Of course, Lord Davenport," she heard herself say. She was a coward. A miserable coward. And then, as if he were some sort of wind-up toy that someone had twisted off, Lord Davenport sat back in his seat, perfectly composed.
"I'm glad to hear of it,"
he said, dabbing at the corner of his mouth with his serviette.
"I'm reassured to see that they still teach deference and respect at Miss Moss's. I do not regret my choice in having you sent there."
Lucy's fork halted halfway to her mouth.
"I did not realize you had made the arrangements."
"I had to do something,"
he grunted, looking at her as if she were a feeble mind.
"You haven't a mother to make sure you're properly schooled for your role in life. There are things you'll need to know to be a countess, skills you must possess."
"Of course,"
she said deferentially, having decided that a show of absolute meekness and obedience would be the quickest way to put an end to the torture.
"And thank you."
"For what?"
Hazelby asked. Lucy turned to her fiancé. He appeared to be genuinely curious.
"Why, for having sent me to Miss Moss's," she explained, carefully directing her answer at Hazelby. Maybe if she didn't look at Lord Davenport, he would forget she was there.
"Did you enjoy it, then?"
Hazelby asked.
"Yes, very much," she replied, somewhat surprised at how very nice it felt to be asked a polite question. "It was lovely. I was extremely happy there."
Hazelby opened his mouth to reply, but to Lucy's horror, the voice that emerged was that of his father.
"It's not about what makes one happy,"
came Lord Davenport's blustery roar. Lucy could not take her eyes off the sight of Hazelby's still open mouth. Really, she thought, in a strange moment of absolute calm, that had been almost frightening.
Hazelby shut his mouth and turned to his father with a tight smile.
"What is about, then?" he inquired, and Lucy could not help but be impressed at the absolute lack of displeasure in his voice.
"It's about what one learns," his father answered, letting one of his fists bang down on the table in a most unseemly manner. "And who one befriends."
"Well, I did master the multiplication tables," Lucy put in mildly, not that anyone was listening to her.
"She will be a countess," Davenport boomed. "A countess."
Hazelby regarded his father equably. "She will only be a countess when you die," he murmured. Lucy's mouth fell open. "So really," Hazelby continued, casually dropping a minuscule bite of fish into his mouth, "it won't matter much to you, will it?" Lucy turned to Lord Davenport, her eyes very, very wide. The Earl's skin flushed. It was a horrible colour, angry, dusky and deep, made worse by the vein that was positively jumping in his left temple. He was staring at Hazelby, his eyes narrowed with rage. There was no malice there, no wish to do ill or harm, but although it made absolutely no sense, Lucy would have sworn in that moment that Davenport hated his son. And Hazelby just said, "Fine weather we're having." And he smiled. Smiled? Lucy gaped at him. It was pouring and had been for days. But more to the point, didn't he realize that his father was one cheeky comment away from an apoplectic fit? Lord Davenport looked ready to spit, and Lucy was quite certain she could hear his teeth grinding from across the table. And then, as the room practically pulsed with fury, Uncle Robert stepped into the breach.
"I'm pleased we have decided to hold the wedding here in London," he said, his voice even and smooth and tinged with finality, as if to say, "We are done with that, then." "As you know," he continued, while everyone else regained his composure, "Fensworth was married at the Abbey just 2 weeks ago, and while it does put one in the mind of ancestral history, I believe the last 7 earls held their weddings in residence, really hardly anyone was able to attend."
Lucy suspected that had as much to do with the hurried nature of the event as with its location, but this didn't seem the time to weigh in on the topic, and she had loved the wedding for its smallness. Richard and Hermione had been so very happy, and everyone in attendance had come out of love and friendship. It had truly been a joyous occasion, until they had left the next day for their honeymoon trip to Brighton. Lucy had never felt so miserable and alone as when she stood in the drive and waved them away. They would be back soon, she reminded herself, before her own wedding. Hermione would be her only attendant, and Richard was to give her away. And in the meantime, she had Aunt Harriet to keep her company, and Lord Davenport, and Hazelby, who was either utterly brilliant or completely insane. A bubble of laughter, ironic, absurd, and highly inappropriate, pressed in her throat, escaping through her nose with an inelegant snort.
"Huh?"
Lord Davenport grunted. "It is nothing," she hastily said, coughing as best she could. A bit of food. The fishbone, probably." It was almost funny. It would have been funny, even if she'd been reading it in a book. It would have had to have been a satire, she decided, because it certainly wasn't a romance, and she couldn't bear to think it might turn out a tragedy. She looked around the table at the 3 men who presently made up her life. She was going to have to make the best of it. There was nothing else to do. There was no sense in remaining miserable, no matter how difficult it was to look on the bright side, and truly, it could have been worse. So she did what she did best, and tried to look at it all from a practical standpoint, mentally cataloguing all the ways it could have been worse. But instead, Gregory Bridgerton's face kept coming to mind, and all the ways it could have been better. Chapter 14, in which our hero and heroine are reunited, and the birds of London are ecstatic. When Gregory saw her, right there in Hyde Park, his first day back in London, his first thought was, well, of course. It seemed only natural that he would come across Lucy Abernathy in what was literally his first hour out and about in London. He didn't know why, There was no logical reason for them to cross paths, but she had been much in his thoughts since they had parted ways in Kent, and even though he'd thought her still off at Fensworth, he was strangely unsurprised that hers would be the first familiar face he'd see upon his return after a month in the country. He'd arrived in town the night before, uncommonly weary after a long trip on flooded roads, and he'd gone straight to bed. When he woke, rather earlier than usual, actually, the world was still wet from the rains, but the sun had popped out and was shining brightly. Gregory had immediately dressed to go out. He loved the way the air smelled clean after a good stormy rain, even in London. No, especially in London. It was the only time the city smelled like that, thick and fresh, almost like leaves. Gregory kept a small suite of rooms in a tidy little building in Marylebone, and though his furnishings were spare and simple, he rather liked the place. It felt like home. His brother and his mother had on multiple occasions invited him to live with them. His friends thought him mad to refuse. Both residences were considerably more opulent, and more to the point, better staffed than his humble abode. But he preferred his independence. It wasn't that he minded them telling him what to do. They knew he wasn't going to listen, and he knew he wasn't going to listen. But for the most part, everyone remained rather good-natured about it. It was the scrutiny he couldn't quite tolerate. Even if his mother was pretending not to interfere in his life, he knew that she was always watching him, taking note of his social schedule, and commenting on it. Violet Bridgerton could, when the inclination struck, converse on the topic of young ladies, dance cards, and the intersection thereof, as pertained to her unmarried son, with a speed and facility that could make a grown man's head spin, and frequently did. There was this young lady and that young lady, and would he be pleased to be sure to dance with both of them twice at the next soiree? And above all, he must never, ever forget the other young lady, the one off by the wall. Didn't he see her, standing by herself? Her aunt, he must recall, was a close personal friend. Gregory's mother had a lot of close personal friends. Violet Bridgerton had successfully ushered 7 of her 8 children into happy marriages, and now Gregory was bearing the sole brunt of her matchmaking fervour. He adored her, of course, and he adored that she cared so much for his well-being and happiness, but at times she made him want to pull his hair out. And Anthony was worse. He didn't even have to say anything. His mere presence was usually enough to make Gregory feel that he was somehow not living up to the family name. It was difficult to make one's way in the world with the mighty Lord Bridgerton constantly looking over one's shoulder. As far as Gregory could determine, his eldest brother had never made a mistake in his life, which made his own all the more egregious. But, as luck would have it, this was a problem more easily solved than not. Gregory had simply moved out. It required a fair portion of his allowance to maintain his own residence, small though it was, but it was worth it, every last penny. Even something as simple as this, just leaving the house without anyone wondering why or where, or in his mother's case, to whom. It was lovely. Fortifying. It was strange how a mere stroll could make one feel like one's own man. But it did. And then, there she was. Lucy Abernathy. In Hyde Park, when by all rights, she ought to be still in Kent. She was sitting on a bench, tossing bits of bread at a scruffy lot of birds, and Gregory was reminded of that day he'd stumbled upon her at the back of Aubrey Hall. She had been sitting on a bench then as well, and she had seemed so subdued. In retrospect, Gregory realized that her brother had probably just told her that her engagement had been finalized. He wondered why she hadn't said anything to him. He wished she'd said something to him. If he had known that she was spoken for, he would never have kissed her. It went against every code of conduct to which he held himself. A gentleman did not poach upon another man's bride. It was simply not done. If he had known the truth, he would have stepped away from her that night, and he would have... He froze. He didn't know what he would have done. How was it that he had rewritten the scene in his mind countless times, and he only now realized that he had never quite got to the point where he pushed her away? If he had known, would he have set her on her way right at that first moment? He'd had to take hold of her arms to steady her, but he could have shifted her toward her destination when he let go. It would not have been difficult, just a little shuffle of the feet. He could have ended it then, before anything had had a chance to begin. But instead, he had smiled, and he had asked her what she was doing there, and then, good God, what had he been thinking? He had asked her if she drank brandy. After that, well, he wasn't sure how it had happened, but he remembered it all, every last detail. The way she was looking at him, her hand on his arm. She'd been clutching him, and for a moment it had almost felt like she needed him. He could be her rock, her center. He had never been anyone's center. But it wasn't that. He hadn't kissed her for that. He'd kissed her because... Hell, he didn't know why he'd kissed her. There had just been that moment, that strange, inscrutable moment, and it had all been so quiet, a fabulous, magical, mesmerizing silence that seemed to seep into him and steal his breath. The house had been full, teeming with guests even, but the hallway had been theirs alone. Lucy had been gazing up at him, her eyes searching, and then, somehow, she was closer. He didn't recall moving or lowering his head, but her face was just inches away, and the next he knew. He was kissing her. From that moment on, he had been quite simply gone. It was as if he'd lost all knowledge of words, of rationality and thought. His mind had become a strange pre-verbal thing. The world was color and sound, heat and sensation. It was as if his mind had been subsumed by his body. And now he wondered, when he let himself wonder, if he could have stopped it. If she hadn't said no, if she hadn't pressed her hands to his chest and told him to stop, would he have done so on his own? Could he have done so? He straightened his shoulders, squared his jaw. Of course he could have. She was Lucy, for heaven's sake. She was quite wonderful in quite a number of ways, but she wasn't the sort men lost their heads over. It had been a temporary aberration, momentary insanity brought on by a strange and unsettled evening. Even now, sitting on a bench in Hyde Park with a small fleet of pigeons at her feet, she was clearly the same old Lucy. She hadn't seen him yet, and it felt almost luxurious just to observe. She was on her own, save for her maid, who was twiddling her thumbs two benches over. And her mouth was moving. Gregory smiled. Lucy was talking to the birds, telling them something. Most likely she was giving them directions, perhaps setting a date for future bread-tossing engagements, or telling them to chew with their beaks closed. He chuckled. He couldn't help himself. She turned. She turned and she saw him. Her eyes widened and her lips parted, and it hit him squarely in the chest. It was good to see her, which struck him as a rather odd sort of reaction, given how they'd parted. "Lady Lucinda," he said, walking forward, "this is a surprise. I had not thought you were in London." For a moment it seemed she could not decide how to act, and then she smiled, perhaps a bit more hesitantly than he was accustomed to, and held forward a slice of bread. "For the pigeons," he murmured, "or me?" Her smile changed, grew more familiar. "Whichever you prefer, although I should warn you, it's a bit stale." His lips twitched. "You've tried it, then?" And then it was as if none of it had happened. The kiss, the awkward conversation the morning after, it was gone. They were back to their odd little friendship, and all was right with the world. Her mouth was pursed as if she thought she ought to be scolding him, and he was chuckling because it was such good fun to bait her. "It's my second breakfast," she said, utterly deadpan. He sat on the opposite end of the bench and began to tear his bread into bits. When he had a good-sized handful, he tossed them all at once, then sat back to watch the ensuing frenzy of beaks and feathers. Lucy, he noticed, was tossing her crumbs methodically, one after another, precisely 3 seconds apart. He counted. How could he not? "The flock has abandoned me," she said with a frown. Gregory grinned as the last pigeon hopped to the feast of Bridgerton. He threw down another handful. "I always host the best parties." She turned, her chin dipping, as she gave him a dry glance over her shoulder. "You are insufferable." He gave her a wicked look.
"It is one of my finest qualities."
"According to whom?"
"Well, my mother seems to like me quite well," he said modestly.
She sputtered with laughter.
It felt like a victory. "My sister, not as much."
One of her brows lifted.
"The one you are fond of torturing?" "I don't torture her because I like to," he said, in a rather instructing sort of tone. "I do it because it's necessary."
"To whom?"
"To all Britain," he said. "Trust me."
She looked at him dubiously.
"She can't be that bad." "I suppose not," he said. "My mother seems to like her quite well, much as that baffles me."
She laughed again, and the sound was good. A nondescript word to be sure, but somehow it got right to the heart of it. Her laughter came from within, warm, rich, and true. Then she turned, and her eyes grew quite serious.
"You like to tease, but I would bet all that I have that you would lay down your life for her."
He pretended to consider this.
"Well, how much do you have?"
"For shame, Mr. Bridgerton. You're avoiding the question."
"Of course I would," he said quietly. "She's my little sister. Mine to torture, and mine to protect."
"Isn't she married now?" He shrugged, gazing out across the park.
"Yes, I suppose St. Clair can take care of her now, God help him."
He turned, flashing her a lopsided smile.
"Sorry."
But she wasn't so high in the instep to take offence. And in fact, she surprised him utterly by saying, with considerable feeling,
"There is no need to apologize. There are times when only the Lord's name will properly convey one's desperation."
"Why do I feel you are speaking from recent experience?"
"Last night," she confirmed.
"Really?"
He leaned in, terribly interested.
"What happened?"
But she just shook her head.
"It was nothing."
"Not if you were blaspheming."
She sighed. "I did tell you you were insufferable, didn't I?"
"Once today, and almost certainly several times before."
She gave him a dry look, the blue of her eyes sharpening as they fixed upon him.
"You've been counting?"
He paused. It was an odd question. Not because she'd asked it. For heaven's sake, he would have asked the very thing, had he been given the same bait. Rather, it was odd because he had the eerie feeling that, if he thought about it long enough, he might actually know the answer. He liked talking with Lucy Abernathy, and when she said something to him, he remembered it. Peculiar, that.
"I wonder," he said, since it seemed a good time to change the topic, "is sufferable a word?"
She considered that.
"I think it must be, don't you?
No one has ever uttered it in my presence."
"This surprises you?"
He smiled slowly, with appreciation.
"You, Lady Lucinda, have a smart mouth."
Her brows arched, and in that moment she was positively devilish.
"It's one of my best-kept secrets."
He started to laugh.
"I'm more than just a busybody, you know."
The laughter grew. Deep in his belly it rumbled until he was shaking with it. She was watching him with an indulgent smile, and for some reason he found that calming. She looked warm, peaceful even, and he was happy to be with her, here on this bench. It was rather pleasant simply to be in her company. So he turned, smiled.
"Do you have another piece of bread?"
She handed him three.
"I brought the entire loaf."
He started tearing them up.
"Are you trying to fatten the flock?"
"I have a taste for pigeon pie," she returned, resuming her slow, miserly feeding schedule. Gregory was quite sure it was his imagination, but he would have sworn the birds were looking longingly in his direction.
"Do you come here often?"
he asked. She didn't answer right away, and her head tilted, almost as if she had to think about the answer. Which was odd, as it was a rather simple question.
"I like to feed the birds," she said. "It's relaxing."
He hurled another handful of bread chunks and quirked a smile.
"Do you think so?"
Her eyes narrowed, and she tossed her next piece with a precise, almost military little flick of her wrist. The following piece went out the same way, and the one after that as well. She turned to him with pursed lips. "It is, if you're not trying to incite a riot."
"Me?" he returned, all innocence. "You're the one forcing them to battle to the death, all for one pathetic crumb of stale bread."
"It's a very fine loaf of bread. Well baked and extremely tasty, I'll have you know."
"On matters of nourishment," he said with overdone graciousness, "I shall always defer to you."
Lucy regarded him dryly. "Most women would not find that complimentary."
"Ah, but you are not most women. And," he added, "I've seen you eat breakfast."
Her lips parted, but before she could gasp her indignation, he cut in with,
"That was a compliment, by the way."
Lucy shook her head. He really was insufferable, and she was so thankful for that. When she'd first seen him, just standing there watching her as she fed the birds, her stomach had dropped and she'd felt queasy, and she didn't know what to say or how to act or really anything. But then he'd ambled forward, and he'd been so himself. He'd put her immediately at ease, which under the circumstances was really quite astonishing. She was, after all, in love with him. But then he'd smiled that lazy, familiar smile of his, and he'd made some sort of joke about the pigeons, and before she knew it, she was smiling in return, and she felt like herself, which was so reassuring. She hadn't felt like herself for weeks. And so, in the spirit of making the best of things, she had decided not to dwell upon her inappropriate affection for him, and instead be thankful that she could be in his presence, without turning into an awkward, stammering fool. There were small favours left in the world, apparently. "Have you been in London all this time?" she asked him, quite determined to maintain a pleasant and perfectly normal conversation. He drew back in surprise. Clearly, he had not expected that question.
"No, I only just returned last night."
"I see." Lucy paused to digest that. It was strange, but she hadn't even considered that he might not be in town. But it would explain, well, she wasn't sure what it would explain, that she hadn't caught a glimpse of him. It wasn't as if she'd been anywhere besides her home, the park and the dressmaker. "Were you at Aubrey Hall then?"
"No, I left shortly after you departed. I went to visit my brother. He lives with his wife and children off in Wiltshire, quite blissfully away from all that's civilized."
"Wiltshire isn't so very far away."
He shrugged. "Half the time they don't even receive the Times. They claim they're not interested."
"How odd." Lucy didn't know anyone who did not receive the newspaper, even in the most remote of counties.
He nodded. "I found it rather refreshing this time, however. I have no idea what anyone is doing, and I don't mind it a bit."
"Are you normally such a gossip?"
He gave her a sideways look. "Men don't gossip. We talk."
"I see," she said. "That explains so much."
He chuckled. "Have you been in town long? I had assumed you were also rusticating."
2 weeks, she replied. "We arrived just after the wedding."
"We? Are your brother and Miss Watson here, then?"
She hated that she was listening for eagerness in his voice, but she supposed it couldn't be helped. "She is Lady Fensworth now, and no, they're on their honeymoon trip. I'm here with my uncle."
"For the season?"
"For my wedding."
That stopped the easy flow of conversation.
She reached into her bag and pulled out another slice of bread. "It is to take place in a week."
He stared at her in shock.
"That soon?" "Uncle Robert says there is no point in dragging it out."
"I see."
And maybe he did.
Maybe there was some sort of etiquette to all this, that she, sheltered girl from the country that she was, had not been taught. Maybe there was no point in postponing the inevitable. Maybe it was all a part of that making the best of things philosophy she was working so diligently to espouse.
"Well," he said.
He blinked a few times, and she realized that he did not know what to say. It was a most uncharacteristic response, and one she found gratifying. It was a bit like Hermione not knowing how to dance.
If Gregory Bridgerton could be at a loss for words, then there was hope for the rest of humanity. Finally, he settled upon, "My felicitations." "Thank you." She wondered if he had received an invitation. Uncle Robert and Lord Davenport were determined to hold the ceremony in front of absolutely everyone. It was, they said, to be her grand debut, and they wanted all the world to know that she was Hazelby's wife. "It is to be at St. George's," she said, for no reason whatsoever. "Here in London?" He sounded surprised. "I would have thought you would marry from Fensworth Abbey." It was most peculiar, Lucy thought, how not painful this was, discussing her upcoming wedding with him. She felt more numb, actually. "It was what my uncle wanted," she explained, reaching into her basket for another slice of bread. "Your uncle remains the head of the household?" Gregory asked, regarding her with mild curiosity. "Your brother is the Earl. Hasn't he reached his majority?" Lucy tossed the entire slice to the ground, then watched with morbid interest as the pigeons went a bit mad. "He has," she replied, "last year. But he was content to allow my uncle to handle the family affairs while he was conducting his postgraduate studies at Cambridge. I expect that he will assume his place soon, now that he is..." She offered him an apologetic smile. "Married." "Do not worry over my sensibilities," he assured her. "I am quite recovered." "Truly?" He gave her a small one-shouldered shrug. "Truth be told, I count myself lucky." She pulled out another slice of bread, but her fingers froze before pinching off a piece. "You do?" she asked, turning to him with interest. "How is that possible?" He blinked with surprise. "You are direct, aren't you?" And she blushed. She felt it, pink and warm and just horrible on her cheeks. "I'm sorry," she said. "That was terribly rude of me. It is only that you were so very much..."
"Say no more,"
he cut her off. And then she felt even worse, because she had been about to describe, probably in meticulous detail, how lovesick he'd been over Hermione, which, had she been in his position, she'd not wish recounted. "I'm sorry," she said. He turned, regarded her with a contemplative sort of curiosity.
"You say that quite frequently."
"I'm sorry." "Yes." I don't know." Her teeth ground together, and she felt quite tense. Uncomfortable. Why would he point out such a thing? "It's what I do," she said. And she said it firmly because... well, because. That ought to be enough of a reason. He nodded, and that made her feel even worse. "It's who I am," she added defensively, even though he'd been agreeing with her for heaven's sake. "I smooth things over, and I make things right." And at that, she hurled the last piece of bread to the ground. His brows rose, and they both turned in unison to watch the ensuing chaos.
"Well done," he murmured.
"I make the best of things," she said. "Always."
"It's a commendable trait," he said softly.
And at that, somehow, she was angry. Really, truly, beastly angry. She didn't want to be commended for knowing how to settle for second best. That was like winning a prize for the prettiest shoes in a foot race. Irrelevant and not the point. "And what of you?" she asked, her voice growing strident. "Do you make the best of things? Is that why you claim yourself recovered? Weren't you the one who waxed rhapsodic over the mere thought of love? You said it was everything, that it gave you no choice. You said..." She cut herself off, horrified by her tone. He was staring at her as if she'd gone mad. And maybe she had. "You said many things," she mumbled, hoping that might end the conversation. She ought to go. She'd been sitting on the bench for at least 15 minutes before he had arrived, and it was damp and breezy, and her maid wasn't dressed warmly enough. And if she thought long and hard enough about it, she probably had 100 things she needed to do at home, or at least a book she could read.
"I'm sorry if I upset you," Gregory said quietly.
She couldn't quite bring herself to look at him.
"But I did not lie to you," he said. "Truthfully, I no longer think of Miss... excuse me,
a Lady Fensworth, with any great frequency, except perhaps to realize that we should not have been well suited after all. She turned to him, and she realized she wanted to believe him. She really did. Because if he could forget Hermione, maybe she could forget him. "I don't know how to explain it," he said, and he shook his head as if he were every bit as perplexed as she. "But if ever you fall madly and inexplicably in love..." Lucy froze. He wasn't going to say it. Surely he couldn't say it. He shrugged. "Well, I shouldn't trust it." Dear God! Hermione's words. Exactly. She tried to remember how she had replied to Hermione, because she had to say something. Otherwise he would notice the silence, and then he'd turn and he'd see her looking so unnerved. And then he would ask questions, and she wouldn't know the answers, and "it's not likely to happen to me," she said, the words practically pouring from her mouth. He turned, but she kept her face scrupulously forward, and she wished desperately that she had not tossed out all the bread. It would be far easier to avoid looking at him if she could pretend to be involved with something else. "You don't believe that you will fall in love?" he asked. "Well, perhaps," she said, trying to sound blithe and sophisticated. "But not that." "That?" She took a breath, hating that he was forcing her to explain. "That desperate sort of thing you and Hermione now disavow," she said. "I'm not the sort, don't you think?" She bit her lip, and finally allowed herself to turn in his direction. Because what if he could tell that she was lying? What if he sensed that she was already in love? With him. She would be embarrassed beyond comprehension. But wouldn't it be better to know that he knew? At least then she wouldn't have to wonder. Ignorance wasn't bliss, not for someone like her. "It's all beside the point anyway," she continued, because she couldn't bear the silence. "I'm marrying Lord Hazelby in 1 week, and I would never stray from my vows. I..."
"Hazelby?"
Gregory's entire body twisted as he swung around to face her.
"You're marrying Hazelby?"
"Yes," she said, blinking furiously. "What sort of reaction was that? I thought you knew."
"No, I didn't."
He looked shocked, stupefied. Good heavens. He shook his head.
"I can't imagine why I didn't know."
"It wasn't a secret."
"No," he said, a bit forcefully. "I mean, no, no, of course not. I did not mean to imply..."
"Do you hold Lord Hazelby in low esteem?" she asked, choosing her words with extreme care.
"No,"
Gregory replied, shaking his head, but just a little, as if he were not quite aware that he was doing it.
"No, I've known him for a number of years. We were at college together, and university."
"Are you of an age, then?" Lucy asked, and it occurred to her that something was a bit wrong if she did not know the age of her fiancé. But then again, she wasn't certain of Gregory's age either. He nodded.
"He's quite affable. He will treat you well."
He cleared his throat.
"Gently."
"Gently," she echoed. It seemed an odd choice of words. His eyes met hers, and it was only then that she realized he had not precisely looked at her since she told him the name of her fiancé. But he didn't speak. Instead, he just stared at her, his eyes so intense that they seemed to change color. They were brown with green, then green with brown, and then it all seemed to almost a blur.
"What is it?" she whispered. "It is of no account," he said, but he did not sound like himself.
And then he turned away, broke the spell.
"My sister," he said, clearing his throat, "she is hosting a soiree tomorrow evening. Would you like to attend?"
"Oh, yes, that would be lovely," Lucy said, even though she knew she should not. But it had been so long since she'd had any sort of social interaction, and she wasn't going to be able to spend time in his company once she was married. She ought not to torture herself now, longing for something she could not have, but she couldn't help it.
"Gather ye rosebuds. Now, because really, when else..."
"Oh, but I can't," she said, disappointment turning her voice to nearly a whine.
"Why not?"
"It's my uncle," she replied, sighing. "And Lord Davenport.
Hazelby's father.
Well, I know who he is.
Of course, I'm sorry. She cut herself off. She wasn't going to say it. They don't wish for me to make my bow yet.
I beg your pardon? Why?
Lucy shrugged. There is no point in my being introduced to society as Lady Lucinda Abernathy when I am to be Lady Hazelby in a week.
Well, that's ridiculous.
It is what they say.
She frowned.
And I don't think they wish to suffer the expense either.
You will attend tomorrow evening, Gregory said firmly. I shall see to it.
You? Lucy asked dubiously.
Not me, he answered, as if she'd gone mad. My mother. Trust me, when it comes to matters of social discourse and niceties, she can accomplish anything. Have you a chaperone?
Lucy nodded. My Aunt Harriet. She's a bit frail, but I'm certain she could attend a party if my uncle allowed it.
He will allow it, Gregory said confidently. The sister in question is my eldest, Daphne. He then clarified. Her Grace, the Duchess of Hastings. Your uncle would not say no to a duchess, would he?
I don't think so, she said slowly.
Lucy could not think of anyone who would say no to a duchess. It's settled, then, Gregory said. You shall be hearing from Daphne by afternoon.
He stood up, offering his hand to help her up. She swallowed. It would be bittersweet to touch him. But she placed her hand in his. It felt warm and comfortable. And safe. Thank you, she murmured, taking her hand back so that she might wrap both around the handle of her basket. She nodded at her maid, who immediately began walking to her side.
Until tomorrow, he said, bowing almost formally as he bade her farewell.
Until tomorrow, Lucy echoed, wondering if it were true. She had never known her uncle to change his mind before, but maybe, possibly, hopefully.
Chapter 15, in which our hero learns that he is not, and probably never will be, as wise as his mother. 1 hour later, Gregory was waiting in the drawing room at No. 5 Bruton Street, his mother's London home, since she had insisted upon vacating Bridgerton House upon Anthony's marriage. It had been his home, too, until he had found his own lodgings several years earlier. His mother lived there alone now, ever since his younger sister had married. Gregory made a point of calling upon her at least twice a week when he was in London, but it never ceased to surprise him how quiet the house seemed now.
"Darling," his mother exclaimed, sailing into the room with a wide smile, "I had not thought to see you until this evening. How was your journey? And tell me everything about Benedict and Sophie and the children. It is a crime how infrequently I see my grandchildren."
Gregory smiled indulgently. His mother had visited Wiltshire just 1 month earlier, and did so several times per year. He dutifully passed along news of Benedict's 4 children, with added emphasis on little Violet, her namesake. Then, once she had exhausted her supply of questions, he said, "Actually, Mother, I have a favour to ask of you." Violet's posture was always superb, but still she seemed to straighten a bit.
"You do? What is your need?"
He told her about Lucy, keeping the tale as brief as possible, lest she reach any inappropriate conclusions about his interest in her. His mother tended to view any unmarried female as a potential bride, even those with a wedding scheduled for the week's end.
"Of course I will assist you," she said. "This will be easy."
"Her uncle is determined to keep her sequestered," Gregory reminded her.
"Child's play, my dear son. Leave this to me. I shall make short work of it."
Gregory decided not to pursue the subject further. If his mother said she knew how to ensure someone's attendance at a ball, then he believed her. Continued questioning would only lead her to believe he had an ulterior motive, which he did not. He simply liked Lucy, considered her a friend, and he wished for her to have a bit more fun. It was admirable, really.
"I shall have your sister send an invitation with a personal note," Violet mused, "and perhaps I shall call upon her uncle directly. I shall lie and tell him I met her in the park."
"Lie?" Gregory's lips twitched. You? His mother's smile was positively diabolical.
It won't matter if he doesn't believe me. It's one of the advantages of advanced years. No one dares to countermand an old dragon like me.
Gregory lifted his brows, refusing to fall for her bait. Violet Bridgerton might have been the mother of 8 adult children, but with her milky, unlined complexion and wide smile, she did not look like anyone who could be termed old. In fact, Gregory had often wondered why she did not remarry. There was no shortage of dashing widowers clamoring to take her into supper or stand up for a dance. Gregory suspected any one of them would have leapt at the chance to marry his mother, if only she would indicate interest. But she did not, and Gregory had to admit that he was rather selfishly glad of it. Despite her meddling, there was something quite comforting in her single-minded devotion to her children and grandchildren. His father had been dead for over 2 dozen years. Gregory hadn't even the slightest memory of the man. But his mother had spoken of him often, and whenever she did, her voice changed, her eyes softened, and the corners of her lips moved just a little, just enough for Gregory to see the memories on her face. It was in those moments that he understood why she was so adamant that her children choose their spouses for love. He'd always planned to comply. It was ironic, really, given the farce with Miss Watson. Just then, a maid arrived with a tea tray, which she set on the low table between them.
"Cook made your favourite biscuits," his mother said, handing him a cup prepared exactly as he liked it. No sugar, one tiny splash of milk.
"You anticipated my visit?" he asked.
"Not this afternoon, no," Violet said, taking a sip of her own tea. "But I knew you could not stay away for long. Eventually, you would need sustenance."
Gregory offered her a lopsided smile. It was true. Like many men of his age and status, he did not have room in his apartments for a proper kitchen. He ate at parties, and at his club, and, of course, at the homes of his mother and siblings.
"Thank you," he murmured, accepting the plate onto which she had piled 6 biscuits.
Violet regarded the tea tray for a moment, her head cocked slightly to the side, then placed 2 on her own plate.
"I'm quite touched," she said, looking up at him, "that you seek my assistance with Lady Lucinda."
"Are you?" he asked curiously. "Who else would I turn to with such a matter?" She took a delicate bite of her biscuit.
"No, I am the obvious choice, of course, but you must realize that you rarely turn to your family when you need something."
Gregory went still, then turned slowly in her direction. His mother's eyes, so blue and so unsettlingly perceptive, were fixed on his face. What could she possibly have meant by that? No one could love his family better than he did.
"That cannot be true," he finally said.
But his mother just smiled.
"Do you think not?"
His jaw clenched.
"I do think not." "Oh, do not take offense," she said, reaching across the table to pat him on the arm. "I do not mean to say that you do not love us, but you do prefer to do things for yourself."
"Such as?"
"Oh, finding yourself a wife?"
He cut her right off there and then. "Are you trying to tell me that Anthony, Benedict, and Colin welcomed your interference when they were looking for wives?"
"No, of course not. No man does. But," she flitted one of her hands through the air as if she could erase the sentence. "Oh, forgive me. It was a poor example."
She let out a small sigh as she gazed out the window, and Gregory realized that she was prepared to let the subject drop. To his surprise, however, he was not.
"What is wrong with preferring to do things for oneself?" he asked.
She turned to him, looking for all the world as if she had not introduced a potentially discomforting topic.
"Why, nothing. I'm quite proud that I raised such self-sufficient sons. After all, 3 of you must make your own way in the world."
She paused, considering this, then added, "With some help from Anthony, of course. I should be quite disappointed if he did not watch out for the rest of you."
"Anthony is exceedingly generous," Gregory said quietly.
"Yes, he is, isn't he?" Violet said, smiling.
"With his money and his time. He's quite like your father in this way."
She looked at him with wistful eyes.
"I'm so sorry you never knew him."
"Anthony was a good father to me." Gregory said it because he knew it would bring her joy,
but he also said it because it was true. His mother's lips pursed and tightened, and for a moment Gregory thought she might cry. He immediately retrieved his handkerchief and held it out to her.
No, 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 that's not necessary, she said, even as she took it and dabbed her eyes. I'm quite all right. Merely a little...
She swallowed, then smiled, but her eyes still glistened.
Some day you will understand, when you have children of your own, how lovely it was to hear that.
She set the handkerchief down and picked up her tea. Sipping it thoughtfully, she let out a little sigh of contentment. Gregory smiled to himself. His mother adored tea. It went quite beyond the usual British devotion. She claimed it helped her to think, which he would normally have lauded as a good thing, except that all too often he was the subject of her thoughts, and after her third cup she had usually devised a frighteningly thorough plan to marry him off to the daughter of whichever friend she had most recently paid a morning call to. But this time, apparently, her mind was not on marriage. She set her cup down, and just when he thought she was ready to change the subject, she said, "But he is not your father." He paused, his own teacup halfway to his mouth. "I beg your pardon?"
"Anthony, he is not your father."
"Yes," he said slowly, because really what could possibly be her point?
"He is your brother," she continued, "as are Benedict and Colin. And when you were small, oh, how you wished to be a part of their affairs."
Gregory held himself very still.
"But of course, they were not interested in bringing you along. And really, who can blame them?"
"Who indeed?" he murmured tightly.
"Oh, do not take offence, Gregory,"
his mother said, turning to him with an expression that was a little bit contrite and a little bit impatient.
"They were wonderful brothers, and truly very patient most of the time."
"Most of the time?"
"Some of the time," she amended. "But you were so much smaller than they were. There simply wasn't much in common for you to do. And then, when you grew older, well..."
Her words trailed off, and she sighed. Gregory leaned forward.
"Well?" he prompted. "Oh, it's nothing."
"Mother?"
"Very well," she said,
and he knew right then and there that she knew exactly what she was saying, and that any sighs and lingering words were entirely for effect.
"I think that you think you must prove yourself to them," Violet said.
He regarded her with surprise.
"Don't I?"
His mother's lips parted, but she made no sound for several seconds.
"No," she finally said. "Why would you think you would?"
"What a silly question. It was because...
It's not the sort of thing one can easily put into words," he muttered.
"Really?" She sipped at her tea.
"I must say, that was not the sort of reaction I had anticipated."
Gregory felt his jaw clench. "What precisely did you anticipate?"
"Precisely?"
She looked up at him with just enough humour in her eyes to completely irritate him.
"I'm not certain that I can be precise, but I suppose I had expected you to deny it."
"Just because I do not wish it to be the case does not render it untrue," he said with a deliberately casual shrug.
"Your brothers respect you," Violet said.
"I did not say they do not.
They recognize that you are your own man."
That, Gregory thought, was not precisely true.
"It's not a sign of weakness to ask for help," Violet continued.
"I have never believed that it was," he replied. "Didn't I just seek your assistance?"
"With a matter that could only be handled by a female," she said somewhat dismissively. "You had no choice but to call on me."
It was true, so Gregory made no comment.
"You're used to having things done for you," she said.
"Mother."
"Hyacinth is the same way," she said quickly. "I think it must be a symptom of being the youngest, and truly I did not mean to imply that either of you is lazy or spoiled or mean-spirited in any way."
"What did you mean, then?" he asked. She looked up with a slightly mischievous smile.
"Precisely?"
He felt a bit of his tension slipping away. "Precisely," he said, with a nod to acknowledge her wordplay.
"I merely meant
that you have never had to work particularly hard for anything. You're quite lucky that way. Good things seem to happen to you.
And as my mother, you're bothered by this?
How?
Oh, Gregory, she said with a sigh, I'm not bothered at all. I wish you nothing but good things, you know that.
He wasn't quite sure what the proper response might be to this, so he held silent, merely lifting his brows in question.
I've made a muddle of this, haven't I? Violet said with a frown. All I'm trying to say is that you have never had to expend much of an effort to achieve your goals. Whether that is a result of your abilities or your goals, I'm not certain.
He did not speak. His eyes found a particularly intricate spot in the patterned fabric covering the walls, and he was riveted, unable to focus on anything else as his mind churned and yearned. And then, before he even realized what he was thinking, he asked, "What has this to do with my brothers?" She blinked uncomprehendingly, then finally murmured,
"Oh, you mean about your feeling the need to prove yourself?"
He nodded. She pursed her lips, thought, and then said,
"I'm not sure."
He opened his mouth. That was not the answer he'd been expecting.
"I don't know everything," she said,
and he suspected it was the first time that particular collection of words had ever crossed her lips.
"I suppose," she said slowly and thoughtfully, "that you, well, it's an odd combination, I should think, or perhaps not so odd when one has so many older brothers and sisters."
Gregory waited as she collected her thoughts. The room was quiet, the air utterly still, and yet it felt as if something were bearing down on him, pressing at him from all sides. He did not know what she was going to say, but somehow he knew. It mattered. Maybe more than anything else he'd ever heard.
"You don't wish to ask for help," his mother said, "because it's so important to you that your brothers see you as a man grown, and yet at the same time, well, life has come easily to you, and so I think sometimes you don't try."
His lips parted.
"It's not that you refuse to try," she hastened to add, "just that most of the times you don't have to. And when something is going to require too much of an effort, if it is something you cannot manage yourself, you decide that it is not worth the bother."
Gregory found his eyes pulling back toward that spot on the wall, the one where the vine twisted so curiously.
"I know what it means to work for something," he said in a quiet voice. He turned to her then, looking her full in the face. "To want it desperately, and to know that it might not be yours."
"Do you? I'm glad." She reached for her tea, then apparently changed her mind and looked up.
"Did you get it?"
"No." Her eyes turned a little bit sad.
"I'm sorry."
"I'm not," he said stiffly. "Not any longer."
"Oh. Well," she shifted in her seat, "then I am not sorry. I imagine you are a better man for it now."
Gregory's initial impulse leaned towards offence, but to his great surprise he found himself saying, "I believe you are correct." To his even greater surprise, he meant it. His mother smiled wisely.
"I'm so glad you are able to see it in that light. Most men cannot."
She glanced up at the clock and let out a chirp of surprise.
"Oh, dear, the time. I promised Portia Featherington that I would call upon her this afternoon."
Gregory stood as his mother rose to her feet.
"Do not worry about Lady Lucinda," she said, hurrying to the door. "I shall take care of everything. And please finish your tea. I do worry about you living all by yourself with no woman to care for you. Another year of this, and you'll waste away to skin and bones."
He walked her to the door. As nudges towards matrimony go, that was particularly unsubtle.
"Was it?"
She gave him an arch look.
"How nice for me that I no longer even try for subtlety. I have found that most men do not notice anything that is not clearly spelled out anyway."
"Even your sons?"
"Especially my sons."
He smiled wryly. "I asked for that, didn't I?
You practically wrote me an invitation."
He tried to accompany her to the main hall, but she shooed him away.
No, 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 that's not necessary. Go and finish your tea. I asked the kitchen to bring up some sandwiches when you were announced. They should arrive at any moment, and will surely go to waste if you don't eat them.
Gregory's stomach grumbled at that exact moment, so he bowed and said, "You are a superb mother. Did you know that?"
"Because I feed you?"
"Well, yes, but perhaps for a few other things as well." She stood on her toes and kissed him on the cheek.
"You are no longer my darling boy, are you?"
Gregory smiled. It had been her endearment for him for as long as he remembered.
"I am for as long as you wish it, mother. As long as you wish it."
Chapter 16, in which our hero falls in love again. When it came to social machinations, Viola Bridgerton was every bit as accomplished as she claimed, and indeed, when Gregory arrived at Hastings House the following evening, his sister Daphne, the current Duchess of Hastings, informed him that Lady Lucinda Abernethy would indeed be attending the ball. He found himself rather unaccountably pleased at the outcome. Lucy had looked so disappointed when she told him that she would not be able to go, and really, shouldn't the girl enjoy one last night of reverie before she married Hazelby? Hazelby. Gregory still couldn't quite believe it. How could he have not known that she was marrying Hazelby? There was nothing he could do to stop it. And really, it wasn't his place, but, dear God, it was Hazelby. Shouldn't Lucy be told? Hazelby was a perfectly amiable fellow, and, Gregory had to allow, in possession of a more than acceptable wit. He wouldn't beat her, and he wouldn't be unkind, but he didn't... he couldn't. He would not be a husband to her. Just the thought of it left him grim. Lucy wasn't going to have a regular marriage because Hazelby didn't like women. Not the way a man was meant to. Hazelby would be kind to her, and he'd probably provide her with an exceedingly generous allowance, which was more than many women had in their marriages, regardless of their husband's proclivities. But it did not seem fair that of all people, Lucy was destined for such a life. She deserved so much more. A house full of children, and dogs, perhaps a cat or two. She seemed the sort who'd want a menagerie. And flowers. In Lucy's home, there would be flowers everywhere, he was certain of it. Pink peonies, yellow roses, and that stalky blue thing she liked so well. Delphinium, that was it. He paused, remembered. Delphinium. Lucy might claim that her brother was the horticulturist of the family, but Gregory could not imagine her living in a home without colour. There would be laughter and noise and splendid disarray, despite her attempts to keep every corner of her life neat and tidy. He could see her easily in his mind's eye, fussing and organising, trying to keep everyone on a proper schedule. It almost made him laugh aloud just to think of it. It wouldn't matter if there were a fleet of servants dusting and straightening and shining and sweeping. With children, nothing was ever quite where one put it. Lucy was a manager. It was what made her happy, and she ought to have a household to manage. Children. Lots of them. Maybe 8. He glanced around the ballroom, which was slowly beginning to fill. He didn't see Lucy, and it wasn't so crowded yet that he might miss her. He did, however, see his mother. She was heading his way.
"Gregory," she said, reaching out to him with both hands when she reached him, "you look especially handsome this evening."
He took her hands and raised them to his lips. "Said with all the honesty and impartiality of a mother," he murmured.
"Nonsense," she said with a smile.
"It is a fact that all my children are exceedingly intelligent and good-looking. If it were merely my opinion, don't you think someone would have corrected me by now?"
"As if anyone would dare."
"Well, yes, I suppose," she replied, maintaining an impressively impassive face. "But I shall be stubborn and insist that the point is moot."
"As you wish, mother," he said with perfect solemnity. "As you wish."
"Has Lady Lucinda arrived?"
Gregory shook his head.
"Not yet."
"Isn't it odd that I haven't met her?" she mused. "One would think if she had been in town a fortnight already. Ah, well, it matters not.
I am certain I will find her delightful if you have made such an effort to secure her attendance this evening."
Gregory gave her a look. He knew this tone. It was a perfect blend of nonchalance and utter precision, usually utilized while digging for information. His mother was a master at it. And sure enough, she was discreetly patting her hair and not quite looking at him as she said, "You said you were introduced while you were visiting Antony, did you not?"
He saw no reason to pretend he did not know what she was about.
"She is engaged to be married, Mother," he said with great emphasis. And then, for good measure, he added, "In 1 week."
"Yes, yes, I know. To Lord Davenport's son. It's a long-standing match, I understand."
Gregory nodded. He couldn't imagine that his mother knew the truth about Hazelby. It was not a well-known fact. There were whispers, of course. There were always whispers. But none would dare repeat them in the presence of ladies.
"I received an invitation to the wedding," Violet said.
"Did you?"
"It's to be a very large affair, I understand."
Gregory clenched his teeth a bit. "She is to be a countess."
"Yes, I suppose. It's not the sort of thing one can do up small."
"No." Violet sighed.
"I adore weddings."
"Do you?"
"Yes."
She sighed again, with even more drama, not that Gregory would have imagined it possible.
"It is all so romantic," she added. "The bride, the groom,
both are considered standard in the ceremony, I understand." His mother shot him a peevish look.
"How could I have raised a son who is so unromantic?"
Gregory decided there could not possibly be an answer to that.
"Fie on you, then," Violet said. "I plan to attend. I almost never refuse an invitation to a wedding."
And then came the voice.
"Who is getting married?"
Gregory turned. It was his younger sister, Hyacinth, dressed in blue and poking her nose into everyone else's business, as usual.
"Lord Hazelby and Lady Lucinda Abernethy," Violet answered.
"Oh, yes," Hyacinth frowned. "I received an invitation. At St. George's, is it not?"
Violet nodded.
"Followed by a reception at Fensworth House."
Hyacinth glanced around the room. She did that quite frequently, even when she was not searching for anyone in particular.
"Isn't it odd that I haven't met her? She is sister to the Earl of Fensworth, is she not?"
She shrugged.
"Odd that I have not met him either."
"I don't believe Lady Lucinda is out," Gregory said. "Not formally, at least."
"Then tonight will be her debut," his mother said. "How exciting for us all."
Hyacinth turned to her brother with razor-sharp eyes.
"And how is it that you're acquainted with Lady Lucinda, Gregory?"
He opened his mouth, but she was already saying,
"And do not say that you are not, because Daphne has already told me everything."
"Then why are you asking?"
Hyacinth scowled. "She did not tell me how you met."
"You might wish to revisit your understanding of the word everything." Gregory turned to his mother. Vocabulary and comprehension were never her strong suits. Violet rolled her eyes.
"Every day I marvel that the two of you managed to reach adulthood."
"Afraid we'd kill each other?" Gregory quipped.
"No, that I'd do the job myself."
"Well," Hyacinth stated, as if the previous minute of conversation had never taken place,
"Daphne said that you were most anxious that Lady Lucinda receive an invitation. And Mother, I understand, even penned a note saying how much she enjoys her company, which, as we all know, is a bald-faced lie, as none of us has ever met the—" "Do you ever cease talking?" Gregory interrupted.
"Not for you,"
Hyacinth replied. "How do you know her? And more to the point, how well? And why are you so eager to extend an invitation to a woman who will be married in a week?"
And then, amazingly, Hyacinth did stop talking.
"I was wondering that myself," Violet murmured.
Gregory looked from his sister to his mother and decided he hadn't meant any of that rot he'd said to Lucy about large families being a comfort. They were a nuisance, and an intrusion, and a whole host of other things, the words for which he could not quite retrieve at that moment, which may have been for the best, as none of them were likely to have been polite. Nonetheless, he turned to the two women with extreme patience and said,
"I was introduced to Lady Lucinda in Kent, at Kate and Antony's house party last month. and I asked Daphne to invite her this evening because she's an amiable young lady, and I happened upon her yesterday in the park. Her uncle has denied her a season, and I thought it would be a kind deed to provide her with an opportunity to escape for one evening. He lifted his brows, silently daring them to respond. They did, of course. Not with words. Words would never have been as effective as the dubious stares they were hurling in his direction.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," he nearly burst out. "She is engaged. To be married."
This had little visible effect. Gregory scowled. "Do I appear to be attempting to put a halt to the nuptials?" Hyacinth blinked, several times, the way she always did when she was thinking far too hard about something not her affair. But to his great surprise, she let out a little, of acquiescence, and said, "I suppose not." She glanced about the room. "I should like to meet her, though."
"I'm sure you will," Gregory replied, and he congratulated himself, as he did at least once a month, on not strangling his sister.
"Kate wrote that she's lovely," Violet said.
Gregory turned to her with a sinking feeling. "Kate wrote to you?" Good God, what had she revealed? It was bad enough that Anthony knew about the fiasco with Miss Watson. He had figured it out, of course. But if his mother found out, his life would be utter hell. She would kill him with kindness. He was sure of it.
"Kate writes twice a month," Violet replied, with a delicate one-shouldered shrug. "She tells me everything."
"Is Anthony aware?" Gregory muttered.
"I have no idea," Violet said, giving him a superior look. "It's really none of his business."
Good God. Gregory just managed to not say it aloud.
"I gather," his mother continued, "that her brother was caught in a compromising position with Lord Watson's daughter."
"Really?"
Hyacinth had been perusing the crowd, but she swung back for that. Violet nodded thoughtfully.
"I had wondered why that wedding was so rushed."
"Well, that's why," Gregory said, a little bit like a grunt.
"Hmm."
This from Hyacinth. It was the sort of sound one never wished to hear from Hyacinth. Violet turned to her daughter and said,
"It was quite the to-do."
"Actually," Gregory said, growing more irritated by the second, "it was all handled discreetly."
"There are always whispers," Hyacinth said.
"Or don't you add to them," Violet warned her.
"I won't say a word,"
Hyacinth promised, waving her hand as if she'd never spoken out of turn in her life. Gregory let out a snort.
"Oh, please."
"I won't," she protested. "I'm superb with the secret, as long as I know it is a secret."
"Ah, so what you mean, then, is that you possess no sense of discretion?"
Hyacinth narrowed her eyes. Gregory lifted his brows.
"How old are you?" Violet interjected. "Goodness, the two of you haven't changed a bit since you were in leading strings. I half expect you to start pulling each other's hair right on the spot."
Gregory clamped his jaw into line and stared resolutely ahead. There was nothing quite like a rebuke from one's mother to make one feel 3 feet tall.
"Oh, don't be a stuff, mother," Hyacinth said, taking the scolding with a smile. "He knows I only tease him so because I love him best."
She smiled up at him, sunny and warm. Gregory sighed, because it was true, and because he felt the same way, and because it was nonetheless exhausting to be her brother. But the two of them were quite a bit younger than the rest of their siblings, and as a result, had always been a bit of a pair.
"He returns the sentiment, by the way," Hyacinth said to Violet. "But as a man, he would never say as much."
Violet nodded.
"It's true."
Hyacinth turned to Gregory.
"And just to be perfectly clear, I never pulled your hair."
Surely his signal to leave, or lose his sanity. Really, it was up to him.
"Hyacinth," Gregory said, "I adore you. You know it. Mother, I adore you as well. And now, I am leaving."
"Wait," Violet called out.
He turned around. He should have known it wouldn't be that easy.
"Would you be my escort?"
"To what?"
"Why, to the wedding, of course."
Gad, what was that awful taste in his mouth?
"Whose wedding? Lady Lucinda's?" His mother gazed at him with the most innocent blue eyes.
"I shouldn't like to go alone."
He jerked his head in his sister's direction. Take Hyacinth. She'll wish to go with Gareth, Violet replied. Gareth St. Clair was Hyacinth's husband of nearly 4 years. Gregory liked him.